Hello and welcome to this webinar from the Business Marketing Club, or BMC. My name is Dave Stevens. I'm a B2B marketer and I'm chair and co-founder of the BMC. The Business Marketing Club is a not-for-profit community network of business marketing professionals and people interested in business marketing. It's run by business marketers for business marketers, and we provide face-to-face and virtual event meetups, podcasts, training, blogs, newsletters, mentoring, social media groups, community groups, and gatherings for business marketers. And today we've got over 1,000 participants across the world. If this is the first time you've joined us, you're very welcome. Check us out at businessmarketingclub.org.uk. Or if you've been with us before, well, welcome back. It's really good to have you along again. This is the penultimate of our webinars on how business marketers are dealing with change. We're living in a world of uncertainty with COVID-19, recession, and political and social conflict dominating our lives. And that calls for us to do business marketing differently, both now and in the future. Over the course of this webinar series, we'll hear from client side and agency side marketers in businesses, from startup all the way through to mature corporates, about topics ranging from changes in working practices to changes in purpose and culture, brand, marketing strategy, messages and channels. They'll be sharing experiences and offering advice. We could have called the series Share and Offer, but then we landed on the more catchy Show and Tell. And we'll hear shortly how today's speakers are seeing the impact of change on diversity in B2B marketing, on personalization in enterprise sales and marketing, amongst other topics. As you listen, type a question or comment into the questions box, and I'll put your questions and comments to the speaker after we've heard from them. If you represent a business that has a B2B marketing project or role that you'd like to ask for help from the community in filling on this call, drop some details in the questions box too, and I'll mention it at the end of this webinar. Please also flag in the questions box if you'd like to be a speaker at a future BMC webinar, or write about this one, or find out more about the BMC, and I'll be in touch. You can tweet along to today's webinar using the hashtag BMCShowTell. That's BMCShowTell. So let's stop prevaricating and get started. Our first speaker today is Richard Robinson. Richard is a seasoned commercial and marketing leader in technology, digital and data sectors. He's had leadership roles in diverse businesses, including Google, industry analyst firm IDC, ad tech firm Turn, and data science business Cambridge Analytica. He also co-founded personality-based marketing startup DPL and is now general manager at gamification platform Lead Family. He's also the chair of the DMA's B2B Council. And so I'm really chuffed that Richard has made time to join us today. Richard, welcome to the webinar, and over to you.
Fantastic. And thanks for that great introduction, Dave. You know more about me than I do, which is wonderful. It's a real pleasure, actually, to be here, because I've been an avid listener of the webinars over recent months. It's got me through some of those dark days of high summer. So I'm looking forward to participating today and obviously contributing moving forward. So thanks for that. Yes, as Dave mentioned, I'm a GM at a business called Lead Family, and I've got this background very focused on B2B and tech and digital and all those wonderful things as well. I thought it's probably worthwhile just giving a very, very brief update on who Lead Family is, as many of you probably won't have heard of them as a business. Lead Family offers a game-based lifecycle marketing software, which enables companies in any industry really to successfully contact, engage and grow their customers across the whole of that customer lifecycle. It's a business that was set up in Denmark in about 2017, so it's about 3 years old, and it's a SaaS-based model. And now we have companies all over the world and over 500 clients, so we're very much in that growth mode of businesses. So we're very much a scale-up business, and everything, I'll be honest with you, everything was going amazingly well until the start of this year, when we hit the crisis. And this kind of led me to the reflection of what I wanted to share today, which is kind of the journey that we've been on as a business over that period and the impact that this change has made to us. I'm sure you're all aware and have heard the quote by Churchill, which he said says something along the lines of never let a good crisis go to waste. And, you know, honestly, for many of us, there's nothing good about what's going on at the moment. And it does sound a little trite. But I think from my perspective, I think personally and as a business, this situation has given us an opportunity to reevaluate what we're about and what we're doing. As many companies, we've needed to act quickly. However, the culture in Lead Family is not one of cutting staff, reducing budgets, pulling back on marketing to try and survive. The approach has very much been around one that's focused very much on finding the way to thrive. So moving away from surviving and moving to thriving. So and I'd like to share some thoughts on how we've done that. So I think first and foremost, we took a big step of examining what we do as a business, what our core value proposition is, and how this resonates with our core target audience. And to be honest, we're a marketing MarTech SaaS platform. And to be completely transparent at the start of this, the last thing that our customers were looking for was another piece of technology to plug into their already complicated MarTech stack. And what they were looking for, you know, is very much around how can we do more with less in terms of fewer people, reduced budgets, less reliance on external partners, taking more control, looking at, understanding and realizing the urgency of getting closer to customers. So how do you actually understand your customers and your prospects better in this time of huge uncertainty? And a lot of that's around, you know, collecting more insight and data around them. And then finally, you know, around measurement, you know, ensuring that everything that can be measured is being measured and providing demonstrable tangible results. And I'm guessing this is sounding familiar for all of you, because certainly when I put my marketing hat on, that's exactly what we needed. So it makes complete sense that, you know, we need to understand what our customers want and then be able to offer the solutions accordingly. We spent a significant amount of time over recent months working through these pain points and refocusing our business to answer these needs. And as part of this, we've gone through an exercise of improving our commercial efficiency, as I know that many of you guys are and your customers are. And this involved a couple of key things. One is around streamlining business processes across all areas, including marketing. We've done quite a lot of work around that. It's about changing our go-to-market approach specifically, but not only relating to our sales functions. We've done a lot of work around that. Tightening up our relationships between sales and marketing and customer success. I've been in this a long game, and I've been to more webinars and more events than I can imagine about sales and marketing alignment. Trust me, this is the time that really needs to come together. And ultimately, and this is something that I'm sure many are already doing, but to us it was quite new, is turning customers into advocates. So really relying on proving value to our customers and helping them actually take our messages to market. The most dramatic change, if I'm honest, has been our approach to market, especially in relation to new business. And this has been kind of huge for us. So we've decided to focus on how we can help our customers and our potential customers and prospects use their budget wisely. And this really has made us be focused around making sure that we are a good fit for our customers and our customers are a good fit for us. This has been a huge shift for us. And now we've got to a stage where if we think that we're not a good fit for our customer, i.e. we're going to risk them, you know, wasting some of their money and their time, and importantly, we're going to waste time and money on it as well, we've decided just to be upfront about that and say, listen, we don't think that you're ready for us. We don't think we're ready for you. We're very happy to share experience and best practice and help them better understand what they need to be doing, but it's not the right client for us, and we're not the right partner for you. Now, that has actually been a huge impact on us and a huge impact on our sales folk, as you can imagine. They've gone through a lot of trauma about this, about whether, you know, we can actually start to turn business away. It's also had a huge impact on our marketing approach. Whereas in the past, our marketing team has been, you know, completely driven by sales demand for leads. Give me more leads, no matter, they can't define what a lead is, but give me more of them. And now we've kind of shifted to, it's all about quality. So if we can get better quality leads, we don't need so many of them. It's improving the process and the efficiency that we're getting out of that. Okay, some of our sales guys are still demanding lots and lots of leads, but you know, it's still a work in process. But what we're genuinely seeing is an improvement in the ratios between MQLs to SQLs, an increase in SQLs to opportunities, and ultimately leading to a higher conversion rate and an increased average order value. So we've actually seen, by really focusing down on what our value proposition is with the right types of prospects through our marketing funnel, we've actually seen greater results out of that. We've also looked at the need to increase execution agility in marketing. We're looking at reducing interdependence, especially between our marketing team and external partners. We still, we've seen a definite move for taking more control in-house. This transformation has seen the need to stay extremely close to all aspects of our business. So we're still working with trusted partners, but fewer of them. And we're doing what I like to call having our hands on the keyboard ourselves. So we're very much hands-on in what we're trying to do. Like everyone else, we're doubling down and have doubled down our focus on existing customers. And our CS team and our marketing team have really been working tightly together to make sure that we're providing that proper, engaged, ongoing relationships. Again, this is around that strategy of turning customers into advocates. And also, we've got this new business approach where we're saying to companies that perhaps we don't feel we're the right fit for them. We're actually starting to do that with our existing customers as well, to make sure that to work with us, we need to be able to provide the value to them, but they also need to be ready to work with us. So as we enter this era of unpredictability, we need to take stack. We need to kind of stack the odds in our favor to do this. And the way that we're doing this, I guess my three key takeouts are, to be really laser focused about the value that we're bringing to our customers and our partners, and ensure that this is mirrored across all touch points, whether that's through sales or marketing or CS or whatever the engagement is. We definitely believe that simple is much better than complex, and that's simplicity in our processes, in simplicity in our messaging, in our value proposition, basically across the whole remit. We're very firmly believe in terms of taking control. I mentioned this phrase of hands-on keyboard. This allows us execution agility, doing things quickly, being really close to the business. And then the final takeout for me is around mindset. So really moving from this mindset of from surviving, we're here to survive, to we're here to thrive. So that very positive outlook that's cascaded across the business about how we can drive our business forward. So that, in probably 4.5 minutes or so, is kind of the status of where we are as a business. And I thought it worthwhile just kind of sharing that, the kind of philosophies and the processes that we've gone through. And hopefully people have found that of interest.
Richard, that was so good. Thank you so much for giving us your experiences of what sounds like a bit of a roller coaster ride from over the last few months. If people have got questions for Richard, bung them in the questions box over the course of the next sort of 30 minutes or so, and start your question with Richard, and I'll get those questions to Mr. Robinson after we've heard from all of our speakers. I was going to go to Perrin Fark next, but I'm not sure she's yet on the line. So instead, I'm going to go to another speaker, Robert Norum, who is joining us on the ether, I hope. Robert has worked in B2B marketing for over 30 years and specialized in ABM for the last 9 years, working with some of the world's largest technology companies in the process. Robert's going to focus today on how change is affecting relevance and personalization in enterprise sales and marketing. Robert, welcome to the webinar, and over to you.
Yeah, thanks, Dave, and good to meet everybody virtually. I'm sorry that my camera has chosen not to play with the GoToWebinar today. So in terms of a bit of a setup, I guess, you know, COVID-19 and the challenging economic climate has obviously made a relevant and personalized approach to enterprise sales and marketing more important than ever. With sales executives no longer able to meet their customers in person, and marketeers no longer able to run physical events, ABM, I think, has become a mission critical driver for business with high value products and services, particularly, and complex sales cycles. So the challenge now for people who are already using ABM, and obviously those who are yet to adopt it, is to make sure that it's fresh and to make sure that it's relevant, obviously as more and more of your competitors are starting to take a similar approach. So in terms of customer expectations, I think it's fair to say that enterprise customers have never been particularly responsive to spray and pray mass marketing. And this is one of the reasons that ABM has become, you know, if not the de facto standard for marketeers in recent years, certainly one of the most popular and heavily used. But it's now even more acute, in the challenging business environment we're facing today, to be timely, to be relevant, and to be personalized. You know, customers are not interested in being targeted as part of a phishing expedition. They want to receive content that's thoughtful, that's relevant, and that's as personalized as it can be from companies that have clearly done their homework. So the more relevant you can be, the more targeted, the more personalized, the better. And I think companies want help from businesses that really understand them and appreciate their business drivers and pain points. They want to feel empathy, and they want to feel common ground with the organizations who are talking to them. They want to feel potentially that, you know, they can have a conversation with them, and that, you know, the company doing the marketing can actually help them. I think another key kind of role, if you like, for ABM right now is internal alignment. ABM has always been tailored to get internal teams working together, particularly sales and marketing. And this is obviously even more important now with employees working remotely. So if you think about ABM, you know, always being in the sort of center spot or sweet spot, if you like, of sales and marketing working together, what you can do now is actually to create joint SWAT teams who are working together remotely to develop strategy and messaging, and making sure that there's real focus on your most important customers and prospects. In terms of some practical advice, inevitably this is where the rubber hits the road, and bringing ABM to life in the current environment is what this is all about, especially as I said, more companies are using ABM than ever. So if you're looking at mission critical accounts, really high value and right at the top of your food chain, you should probably be thinking about a one-to-one approach, which obviously means getting all your internal resources aligned and working together up front on the account, making sure that everybody is on the same page, then doing in-depth research into the account to really understand their needs, and then crafting your strategy and messaging to resonate with key stakeholders. So you really need to put yourself in their shoes and talk to them in a really personal way. If you kind of drop down a layer from one to one, if you're looking at growth accounts or potentially even breaking into companies for the first time, then taking a one to few approach into key verticals is a highly effective form of ABM. And this really means cherry picking a relatively small number of accounts, probably no more than 10 to 15, 20 at the tops. And in this context, I think you should be looking at a sector in detail, but still identifying any uniques by account before crafting, you know, a sector-based strategy and a value proposition to land with the key stakeholders in that business. Again, it's about talking specifically to individuals. So I think looking at their roles and adapting your content to make it as personalized as you can is clearly going to add significant value. And there's been an ongoing debate for many years about one-to-many and whether it's really ABM at all. But I think it really is still a valid option, and it has a role to play in targeting a larger number of accounts, you know, not thousands, but potentially 50 or 100 or even a few hundred. And this is typically, you know, going to be useful where you're trying to bring companies into the top of the funnel to start engaging them with useful and relevant content for the first time. So here, I think, you know, in-depth research isn't possible with those kind of numbers, but it's still really important that you're basing your messaging on insight and understanding, because as I said earlier, you know, customers are not wanting to be marketed to, they're wanting to be engaged in interesting conversations. So another kind of interesting new theme, curiously, I've been working on a purpose project all summer, which isn't even ABM, but I think combining ABM with purpose is maybe a byproduct of our times. And this is where, you know, whilst ABM has always been about talking to your customers in a relevant and timely way, we're now trying to kind of overlay that with genuine empathy, where purpose, you know, is increasingly important. And trying to get to the heart of what it is that you're actually going to do for a company rather than what you're trying to sell them. And I think in the fragile new world we live in, customers have become less interested in solution and product-based marketing. They want to feel they're doing business with companies who have a real purpose and a vision for why they do what they do, you know, and having a purpose and relevance and a commitment to doing the right thing is increasingly important. So I think companies who are either already doing ABM or even just starting out need to think about how are we going to instill purpose, not at a generic company level, but actually into account by account messaging and communications that are going to make them resonate in a much more convincing way with the individuals we want to talk to. So in terms of keeping it fresh, you know, there are obviously so many different options from an ABM point of view, you know, starting off with highly personalized decks for sales, you know, moving into social engagement and digital marketing. But there are obviously lots of new things on the horizon, and that could be targeted account-based advertising. It could be using intent to really try and make sure you're talking to your customers at the right time. And I don't know how everybody else feels about this, but I've also kind of felt that the barriers have come down, and senior decision makers are so used to sitting on Zoom calls now, you know, in their kitchen or in their lounge with a kid wandering through or a cat sitting on the table, that I think the opportunity now for a more relaxed form of engaging groups of people, where you might bring in a specialist speaker or an expert from your company or a third party organization to actually host something, and then perhaps have half a dozen to a dozen senior decision makers talk openly and freely, you know, in a casual environment, is clearly more compelling than perhaps doing, you know, standard webinar format type events. No disrespect to this one, Dave, of course. And I've also come across numerous clients who've even been finding ways of engaging with the customer for them to share their home address and for things to be delivered. You know, so for example, let's have a wine evening whilst we discuss the future of cloud computing. So I think that kind of thing is a nice way of keeping it fresh. And I think ABM, you know, clearly has a significant role to play in this slightly challenging environment we're now operating in. So I'll end there, Dave, and look forward to some questions.
Robert, that's brilliant. Thank you so much for making time to talk to us today. And apologies to everyone listening that as the BMC is a not-for-profit organization, I can't afford to share bottles of wine with all of the people listening today. I promise to try and do better next time. If you've got any questions for Robert, do bung them in the questions box and start your question with Robert. Also, we're welcoming any questions for our first speaker, Richard Robinson. Time now for our third speaker, who I hope is also out there in the ether. If not, I'm going to do a big sort of introduction to her, and then there'll be silence. But we'll see. Fingers crossed. Third speaker is Perrin Farke. Perrin is an award-winning diversity expert and an internationally recognised speaker who's on a mission to make the workplace more inclusive and diverse. And Perrin's going to talk about why B2B marketers should address the lack of diversity in their space right now. Perrin, can you hear us?
I can hear you, and thanks, Dave, for the great introduction. Thank you.
Not at all. It's good that you're here. Welcome to the webinar, and over to you.
Thanks, Dave, and thanks for having me. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm delighted to be here, and thanks for keeping those webinars going. It's just great to have that community, going on despite COVID. So thanks for doing that, Dave. And yes, I wanted to take a slightly different angle. So as you've heard, my name is Perrin Farke. I'm a diversity expert and keynote speaker. And I wanted to start by sharing a recent press article from The Guardian, dated July 2020. And I think most of you will probably remember back in July that Verizon pulled advertising from the Facebook platform over inaction on hate speech. And in that article, Facebook was accused of making a lot of revenue in advertising, but while amplifying the message of white supremacists. And so all this happened, of course, in the context of Black Lives Matter. And we know that the Black Lives Matter movement has been gaining momentum every day in every country. And we do live in a society that is rapidly changing, and consumers and brands and companies' awareness of racial inequalities in our system is at an all-time high. And so in that context, B2B buyers and companies no longer tolerate inaction in regards to systemic racism, for example. And if we look at the marketing industry in particular, the marketing industry also has come under the spotlight recently for really failing to attract diverse talents. So the 2020 Marketing Week Career and Salary Survey found that the marketing industry was 88% white, when we know that if we look at the UK, the UK is 86% white. So we know in London, the white population falls to 56%. So in other words, the marketing industry is there is an overrepresentation of whites in the marketing industry, and an underrepresentation of non-whites. And we know that the diversity numbers are even worse since COVID and remote work. There are three major trends that are happening. So one is distance bias is at play in hiring, which is essentially people's tendency to think that people who are closer to them are more important. So that leads to even more lack of diversity in hiring, and especially in the marketing industry. The second trend that's been happening since COVID in this context is that non-whites have been pushed out of the workforce even more. So minorities, including even women, non-white individuals that were on more junior roles, perhaps, on part-time positions or lower income jobs, have been pushed out of the workforce. So the workforce, especially the marketing, B2B marketing workforce, has become even more homogeneous. And of course, issues around racism have been widely reported since the beginning of Black Lives Matter in May. And so in that context, some B2B brands have taken a stand against racism and the lack of diversity. So as you might remember, Citrix, IBM, Dropbox, Microsoft, HP have taken a strong stand, against racism. But we know that marketers must take action now. So some of you might remember that some very high visibility executives have actually been fired for their poor handling over the Black Lives Matter response. So you may remember that the Red Bull's chief marketing officer has been fired during the summer over his poor handling of the Black Lives Matter response. And consumers, of course, are expecting meaningful action from brands. And so there are some significant risks for B2B marketers if they don't take action. So one is, of course, brand reputation damage, with the lack of representation from minority groups in the workforce. Another very serious risk for B2B marketer of not taking action against racism is boycott, we've all seen in the media that some consumers were actually boycotting even B2B brands over the last few months. And another serious risk as well as a B2B marketer is stagnant audience reach. So we know that organizations with higher diversity really perform better. But at the same time, there are some real business opportunities for B2B marketers who link, you know, diversity, who diversify their team. So one is, you know, if as a B2B marketer, you have a more diverse team, you are going to attract a new customer base and you are going to open up new markets. Another real advantage is that you're going to perform better. You're going to have better performing marketing campaigns. You're going to have better NPS score, which obviously is very important, better customer retention. You will be able to better connect to your diverse consumer base, and also you'll be able to boost your brand image. So the question is, what might a great, you know, B2B marketing team look like? And what role does diversity and inclusion play in building an excellent, you know, marketing team? So, you know, there are a few answers here that I wanted to share with you. So one is, you're going to get an increased engagement and productivity, especially in remote work. We know that teams, you know, marketing teams that actively hire diverse talent in COVID have higher team collaboration. So, you know, CEB, that is now part of Gartner, found that workers in highly diverse and inclusive teams result in 26% increase in team collaboration and 18% increase in team commitment. Also, if you invest in a more diverse team, you're going to get improved team satisfaction and retention. There is a 2019 ADP report that found that employees who trusted that their team leader, they were 12 times more likely to be fully engaged. And 51% of workers say that they feel belonging in the workplace when they can freely share their opinions. So we know that inclusion plays a big part in belonging and staying at the organization. You are also going to get, you know, enhanced organizational success through a collaborative culture. We talked about that Gartner study where, you know, 26% increase in team collaboration when the team was diverse. But also, a Harvard Business Review found that teams with inclusive leaders were 17% more likely to report that they are high performing and 20% more likely to say that they make high quality decisions. And another very serious benefit of having a diverse marketing team is to win over top talent. So a Glassdoor survey revealed that 2/3 of job seekers say a diverse workforce is an important factor when evaluating companies and job offers, which is very important if you want to attract the best talent for your team. We also know that diverse teams get better cultural appreciation and lowers they have lower risks of discrimination. Teams that actively hire diverse talents create opportunities for employees to spend more time with individuals from different backgrounds, which increases their appreciation for different cultures and ways of thinking. And we talked earlier about, you know, how does diversity create better business outcomes for B2B marketeers? Well, one, it really boosts significantly innovation for, you know, changing consumer needs in COVID. So we know that diverse management teams are more innovative than less diverse teams. And that's been confirmed by so many research, including the Boston Consulting Group survey that surveyed 1,700 companies. We also know that diverse teams create more adaptability, which is critical for recovery post-COVID. You know, McKinsey research found that when companies invest in diversity and inclusion, they really are in a better position to create more adaptive, effective teams and more likely to recognize diversity as a competitive advantage. We also know that diverse teams make better decisions. An interesting project from the MIT Sloan School found that when you tell students that they are going to be having a discussion regarding an article, they prepare better and more rigorously if they know they are going to have to debate in a more diverse group. And that's because people expect resistance and they're going to have to present their research to a group that's different from them. So they just prepare better. We also know that diverse teams are more effective at marketing to a broader consumer group. So diversity broadens your customer base. You know, by having a diverse team, you're more likely to learn about the concerns and the preferences of different population segments. And finally, last but not least, diverse teams really get that better reputation, which is good for sales. if your company isn't viewed as inclusive, some customers, including B2B or B2C, may just shy away from giving you their business. So this is especially true with millennials and Generation Z customers, because those two generations are incredibly socially conscious. So as a result, they may prefer inclusive companies when considering spending their budget. And so how can you, as a B2B marketer, make sure that you are going to build that diverse team that's going to be more innovative, better at problem solving, and make better decisions? Well, there are a few simple steps that you can take. So the first step is, I always recommend to start here, is to really articulate how diversity ties to your mission. So let's say you're a B2B marketer for a B2B company. Really ask yourself, how is diversity and inclusion going to help the business? And it might be that you think that inclusive team work better together, or you might think that diverse team is going to help you to open up routes to new markets. And so whatever the reason, it's important that you take the time to answer this question and articulate why diversity is important to your mission. And then the second step is to set goals. It's really important to set diversity and inclusion goals that are tied to monetary compensation, ideally. So saying, you know, that, for example, you might want to reach 50%, you know, female representation in your team in the next 12 months might be a goal, for example. And goal is really going to drive behavior. The third step, once you've done that, is to appoint a diversity task force that's sponsored by an executive. So by appointing a task force, it's almost creating a police that's going to check, you know, and monitor that everything is on track, and just and give you some advice if you fall off, you know, off track. So it's really having that task force that's sponsored by an executive to really implement in action what you've decided. And then the fourth step is to really get real and assess how diverse and inclusive your team is. So you might send an anonymous employee engagement survey within your team, for example, to test how included they feel. You might look at your recent promotions or hires or people leaving your team and just see if there is any pattern in terms of, do they share, you know, any common background. That's going to give you a sense of, you know, where you need to work on more. Then the next step for you would be to really become a change agent and take accountability. So as a B2B marketer or a leader, you really must create a framework and create that commitment and that accountability that starts with you. So, you know, don't expect anybody else to do the work, but really take accountability, you know, and starts with yourself. And at that point, you really want to, that's the last very important step that I would recommend, is to look at, you know, how can you de-bias your team? How can you de-bias your organization? And so there is some controversy around, you know, unconscious bias training, whether it's effective or not. As a diversity consultant, my advice is to try some diversity training that is done the right way. And by that, I mean, you know, with the right content that's really action orientated, you know, with the right content, with the right audience. So ideally the leadership team and the managers, and also within the right context, explaining that that's part of your wider strategy. So with that, I just wanted to leave you with one final statistic. There is a 2018 First One survey that found that 78% of founders have no formal plans or policies in place to promote diversity and inclusion. And so, you know, as founders, as leaders, as team leaders, you know, we all have a responsibility to serve our community and really contribute to social good. So that's why I'm here today. And I wanted to share this message with you, that change doesn't happen by accident and change starts with you. So I do hope today that there is a strong desire to become a change agent to build a more diverse and inclusive workplace.
Karen, inspirational as ever. Thank you very much for that. If people have got questions for you, they should bring them in the questions box and start their question with your name, Perrin. Also, we're welcoming questions for Richard and also for Robert. But let's go to our fourth speaker for today. He is multiple award-winning CMO, Colin Lewis, a man with extensive international experience, a go-to person for brand positioning and for campaign management. He's a contributor to Marketing Week and also to e-consultancy, and he's currently CMO of Open Jaw Technologies. Colin, welcome to the webinar and over to you.
Hello, everybody. Thank you very much for inviting me to this, Dave. OpenShot Technologies are sell e-commerce and big data and conversational interfaces to airlines and loyalty and travel brands across the globe. And so we very much enterprise sales, very much long sales cycle, extensive lead generation programs. And interestingly, we do a lot of business in China. And I can just say this time a year ago, we were in Southwest China in Guilin running a conference with 200 people. And so you're lucky to have me here. I would have been in China otherwise. But yeah, obviously the world has changed so much in the last year. And one thing in my column in Marketing Week, you're probably all familiar with the likes of Mark Ritson and so on, is the notion of marketing effectiveness. And it's become a thing that I'm really kind of interested in for a whole lot of reasons. One is I realized how little I understood the concept over the last few years, and I've really delved down deeply into it and applied it to my day-to-day role in B2B, as a CMO of OpenShot. And the stuff in here that I think we can all learn from, it sounds very patronizing, but I think it's much better than that. We need to actually embed it in our thinking and use it as our lens on how we market in the world of B2B. And I've written down 7 principles of B2B marketing, and I haven't just kind of pulled them out of thin air. Okay, so there's 3 sort of core Bibles, if you will, that I would suggest everybody reads and listens to and examines and looks at. The first one is How Brands Grow, the evidence-based marketing work of Byron Sharp, Building Distinctive Assets by Jenny Romaniuk, and then Effective Marketing for B2B Brands, Learnings from the IPA Data Brand. A Data Bank by Bennett and Field. Now, those 3 are the sort of core, if you will, Bibles, whatever word you want to use there, for to start. Now, they're not exactly bedtime reading. What I would suggest is you go and do your own research on them initially. But let's parse out the 7 things that B2B brands should do right now. So the first one is ensure a differentiated, distinctive positioning in the market. Now, again, sounds from the realm of the bleeding obvious, as John Cleese might say, but actually in so many brands, particularly in B2B, are neither differentiated or distinctive. And actually the word distinctive is the piece to point on here. They do an amazing kind of analysis of what the difference between differentiation and distinctiveness is. And they kind of go and say that, you know, maybe the world isn't as pointed as we used to think, that all brands are totally differentiated. What they do is have distinctiveness in our mind. So let's look at the world of distinctiveness in our B2B brand. And differentiation is good, but distinctiveness is better. So first of all, how is your brand distinctively positioned? So that's step one. Step two, once you kind of have a flavor of that, then is just actively commit to building a strong brand, because strong brands are at the core of marketing effectiveness. Now, what does that really look like in the world of B2B? Well, it means having like a specific look, a specific feel, and obviously content. Richard and the other folks in this call have been talking about content, but making that consistent across all touch points. And, you know, I'm guilty as charged here. I've looked at the content, I've done an assessment of what we do, all the messaging, and I was like, wow, how anybody knows what we do is a miracle beyond. So it's really build out consistency. And the notion of heavy, consistent use of distinctive brand assets. If there's a crime against marketing, and, you know, many of us should be first against the wall with this particular crime, is the fact we change things around a lot. Yeah. And there's a great case study around is it Sunkist, one of the orange businesses, where they changed the logo and on the packaging, and the customers couldn't find it, and sales collapsed 30% in a year. So consistent, distinctive brand assets, and obviously some of the big daddy in the B2B world is IBM. Have they changed their logo much in the last 50 years? No. Okay, they've kept it consistent. Creating distinctive assets around that brand are therefore important. The logos, the colors, and the style that are distinct to you and recognizably so. And I actually use this extensively. I was kind of hamming it up a bit about being in China talking about the conference, but we literally went and said, we're going to own these 3 colors. We're going to have that consistently placed right across every single touch point, and we're going to hammer it like a woodpecker outside on a tree, just banging it away at the same time. So that what we also did was harness and build the power of emotion in communications. One of the things you'll see a lot in B2B is the horrific grab and grin, man and woman in office smiling at each other. And it's just like, please erase those from your library of content. Burn them down. They are horrific. You want to try and build some class of emotion in what you're doing. And, you know, we've just heard from a couple of people using and speaking quite emotionally there. So I don't see what the world of a picture taken in a Regis office on the outskirts of Reading actually has any relevance to emotion whatsoever. Then what we want to talk about is number five, is maximizing mental availability, which is be where the customers are making decisions. Focus on salience, awareness, the top of funnel stuff. One of the lessons that I found the hard way here is that we think we can be perfect in terms of our targeting and our personalization, but actually making the funnel as wide as possible does actually maximize mental availability. And as a distinction, if you'll forgive me using the word again, but I want you to make, which is, I want to maximize mental availability and I also want to maximize digital availability. Finally, point six, our second last point, multiple integrated channels, but using our targeted performance stuff in the short term to drive results, but having the brand and the mental availability to drive long term. And finally, if you can, invest in your shareholders. Growth is driven by spending more than your competitors in your category. So where you can afford it, try to have a higher share of voice above the share of market. Hard to do in tough times, I know, at the moment. And so let's wrap up those 7 points so I can try and stay on time. Ensure distinctive positioning. Build a strong brand. Create great assets. Harness the power of motion. No grab and big grin pictures of Dave and myself in the suburbs of Reading. Maximize mental availability. Multiple integrated channels. Invest in share of voice. Ladies and gentlemen, that is the 7 principles of B2B marketing effectiveness.
And in 5 minutes as well. Colin Lewis, thank you very much. If you've got any questions for Colin, please do put them into the questions box now, and we'll get to them in just a moment. So there you have it. You've heard from our 4 speakers, and we've covered a wide range of content today. We've covered all about how to respond to COVID and really thrive in that space from Richard. We've heard from Robert around applying account-based marketing and personalization techniques today. We've heard from Perrin regarding the importance of looking to diversity in the B2B marketing space. And we've gone really high level with some great principles of B2B marketing from Colin. And so a wide range of things to get to. Let me start with Richard. Richard, I was interested in the kind of almost a program of activities that you laid out there for the way that you responded in your business to COVID. What I'm wondering was it a program, or was it something that kind of you built out incrementally over time? And if the latter, where did you start?
A really good question. I think that we realized as a business pretty early that we needed to kind of change the way that we were going about things. And we actually did start to build out a program. So it is quite a programmatic based approach. Starting point was very much around the value proposition. What is our value proposition? It resonates a lot to those core points that Colin's just gone through. It's like, you know, how do you differentiate yourself in the market? What makes you different? And even to what Robert was talking about is kind of, you know, why are you here? And companies want to do business with companies that are not just selling a product, but they've got a lot more substance to them. So it was very much a case of, okay, we know we need to do something. So let's do this properly. So we built out that program. But we were doing it, you know, in a, I guess, kind of an agile way, if that's not an overused phrase, where we were kind of building and building and building. So we knew the starting point. We don't yet know the end point, but we had that first few months kind of penned out, and we're building from that.
And then I'm also intrigued by when you went into the detail of your program, there were a lot of things there that kind of almost important regardless of COVID? I mean, you talked about sales and marketing alignment, for instance, and so I'm kind of wondering whether there are things that we all as marketers could be putting in place now to preempt the next crisis.
Yeah, I don't think what we're doing is new and innovative and stuff that other people haven't done before. I think it was just there was this catalyst, which was the market situation, that really drove us to speed up what we were planning to do. And yes, there are absolutely things that that we should all be doing now out of that. And yes, sales and marketing alignment is one of them. Yes, better understanding our customers and better engaging with them and putting the right content in front of the right people at the right time. All of these things that Dave, you and I and Colin and Robert and all of us have been doing for many years, but actually bringing it together and doing it in a systematic way, and having the courage, I guess, to really break what you've been doing today. Again, we're a scale-up business. You know, at the beginning of last year, there were, I don't know, about 19 people in the company. Today there's well over 60, and that will continue to grow. And we've recruited through the crisis as well. So you know, what we're doing is, as I said, not new, but there's been this real momentum to realize that we're here today. We want to get there tomorrow. How do we get there? Let's start doing it. And there's a phrase that I like to use. And as you know me so well, Dave, you know, I like to use lots of phrases. And this one is very much around, if not now, when? So it really is a time. Come on, let's crack on and let's do something.
Absolutely. So great stuff. Thanks, Richard. Coming to Robert. Robert, you talked very compellingly about the importance, I thought, of purpose and the work that you'd been doing over the summer in that space. What I'm wondering is, how can you show purpose and intent through the account-based marketing work that you do?
Yeah, great question, Dave. I think it's largely the tone of voice that you talk to customers in. But I think equally, if you go back to the sort of beginning of the food chain, it's about setting expectations internally of how you want to do business with your customers. It's then, you know, using the research and insight to really make sure you're getting under their skin and understanding what their key issues are. And then when you're developing your strategy and your value proposition and messaging, I think it's about creating, you know, a story, if you like, that is really going to resonate with that customer. So, you know, obviously it's not sort of necessary signposting, this is our purpose, but I think it's having an underlying and embedded purpose in everything you do and making sure that it is, you know, as I said many times, as relevant and tailored to the customer as you can make it.
Okay. And you talked too about how COVID has impacted account-based marketing. One of the things that a lot of the people I speak with reflect on is how COVID has changed the nature of the interactions that people have with their clients that are naturally more formalized now, for instance, than maybe they were before the crisis. And I'm wondering whether you are trying to build more informality into the account-based marketing that you're doing, and if so, how?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I sort of alluded to this a little bit at the end when I talked about those kind of informal Zoom drop-ins. You know, if I think back to IBM, you know, even last year, but certainly 3 or 4 years ago, you know, whilst you were doing a lot of work on research and insight to understand the customer, you were still probably creating, you know, a white paper. You were probably creating, you know, a storybook or a video. And those were going into the customer in a sense, in a sort of fairly traditional format. I think given the fact that, you know, everybody is now working remotely and at home, digital marketing obviously has come into a whole new dimension. And I think making connections via social media and talking to people and building relationships definitely takes things down a notch, if you like, in terms of the formality. And then that example I gave you of the sort of Zoom thing with, you know, literally delivering bottles of wine and inviting senior execs to come and meet a CEO and have a chat. You know, so the CEO might start off by saying, well, you know, this is the world we live in and here's our point of view on it. and they might talk informally for 5 or 10 minutes in a sort of fireside chat type way. But then actually having an open conversation with senior execs who are sitting in their lounge and in their dining room and in their kitchen, and it doesn't matter that their wife walks past, you know, or a kid comes and sits on their lap. I think people have actually almost kind of enjoyed that. You know, I mean, when I've been running ABM workshops, I almost kind of created this joke where people got points for if they could get a child into the workshop or if they could get an animal into the workshop, and double points if they could get both, you know. And I think that level of kind of seeing into people's real lives as opposed to just sending them stuff to the office and hoping it works is actually really quite different. And I think it has broken down probably quite a lot of barriers and formality, as you mentioned.
Robert, thanks very much. I'm just imagining the pet bingo that's going to be set off now across all of the webinars around the UK. Perrin, thanks for joining us and giving us a download around diversity. What I thought it was a really compelling case that you made. I guess I was kind of chomping at the bit as I heard you talk about the steps that we could be taking to make our marketing teams more diverse, because I was wondering about whether there were some more kind of practical and immediate things that we can do. So I hear your message to set goals and to set a task force, but I'm wondering whether we should be doing something more overt. Should we be asking for more specific types of people when we place our recruitment ads? Should we be briefing recruitment agencies more specifically about what we're looking for? How do we go beyond the task force into taking action?
Yeah, it's a great question, because what I see over and over is, and I'm sure it will come to no surprise, is there when we talk about diversity and inclusion, particularly within organizations, there is a big, big gap between intentions and action. So for me, as a diversity expert, it's extremely rare for me to speak to a leader of an organization who would say, I don't believe in diversity, or diversity is not important. So in other words, I'd say 95% of leaders in organizations will believe diversity is important and believe that, you know, it's the way forward. But at the same time, there's a big gap between intentions and action. So that's where, you know, that's the problem. And that's why for me, if I have to give one tip, you know, you asked about practical tip, I really believe that setting goals is the key, you know, because, you know, goals drive behaviors, and goals drive to monetary outcomes, drive behavior faster. So in other words, the moment that, you know, there are goals that are set, especially for the leadership team, and especially those goals are tied to monetary compensation, such as bonus, that's when you will see change. Now, if you want practical, you know, you're asking about more practical kind of immediate results, you know, you can do, you know, awareness goes a very, very long way. So, you know, if you're looking for a quick win, you are part of a big organization and things move very slowly and you're wondering what you can do at your level, I'd say, you know, hire someone for a speaking engagement an hour, you know, organize a lunch and learn Friday afternoon for your team, you know, organize a team building with an external speaker, and make sure you talk about things that, whether that's unconscious bias, you know, whether that's bias in hiring, whether that's, you know, practical allyship, whether that's, you know, language, you know, red flag language, or, you know, meetings best practices, whatever the topic, make sure you talk about it, because awareness goes a really long way. So, you know, for example, you can host a lunch and learn with the speaker to talk about allyship in action. You can host a team building, you know, with the speaker to talk about red flag language. But I think that could be a quick win, because once you've done that, you know, once you've created that awareness and people are talking about it, then you will start seeing results and behavior in action.
And the you kind of started your talk by looking at the challenges of the marketers that have chosen to take a stand around Black Lives Matter. And a lot of the marketers that fell on their swords there did so because their organizations weren't really being truly authentic in themselves before they actually came to communicate. I wonder what your view is of B2B marketing organizations taking a political view. Is it something that they should do, or should they really stay out of the limelight?
Yeah, it's a great question, Dave. Traditionally, B2B brands have stayed away from any sort of political statement. So historically, traditionally, B2B brands just don't do politics at all, right? So they would typically shy away from any form of political statement. But I'll say, in the context of Black Lives Matter, and you know, with considering the significant changes that are happening very rapidly in our society today, consumers are more educated than ever before. Consumers, B2B consumers, are expecting organizations to be more transparent. They're expecting organizations to share their diversity reports and to, you know, to do something. So considering the world we live in, it would actually be dangerous and risky for a B2B organization to do nothing. You know, I'm sure you've all heard, you know, silence is compliance. You know, doing nothing is not an option. So I actually think it's more dangerous for a B2B organization to be silent. So I'd say do something, but make sure it's part of a strategic long-term commitment to the city. So if you want to avoid any form of tokenism, make sure that whatever you do is part of a wider strategy, a wider plan, and you have, you know, a long-term plan to address diversity and inclusion.
Thank you. Colin, we've had a number of people ask again for your reading list that you topped your talk with. So I wonder if perhaps just one more time, can you share the great tomes that you suggested were the core of B2B marketing for us?
Only if you send 10 Bitcoin to my Bitcoin bank account right now, David. Partake with the information that I've so assiduously put together over the years. Okay. Well, the first thing is to do get your Google search machine out in front of you and search for effective marketing for B2B brands. Effective marketing for B2B brands, and it's learnings from the IPA databank. Learnings from the IPA databank. But if you just search effective marketing for B2B brands, Bennett and Field, it will come up. LinkedIn have a very good report called B2B Marketing Report Digital as well. Their material is actually quite good, notwithstanding the fact they're a vendor. The second source, the core Bible from 2011, is How Brands Grow by Byron Sharp. And the third one is Building Distinctive Brand Assets by Jenny Romaniuk. Jenny Romaniuk, Jenny with an I, and or Roman IUK. They're based out of the Erin Gerbaski Institute in South Australia. So if you combine the knowledge from the IPA databank, Bennett Field, and Romaniuk and Sharp, you are at the cutting edge of effectiveness. And it has been the best stuff I've read in a 25-year career in marketing. It both reinforced my personal ideas that I couldn't put a name on it and gave it a label, and of course they've made me look like a genius, which is obviously a well thing that I really love. Okay, but the second part of it was it then beat a whole lot of other things that were completely half-assed out of my brain as well, which is also very good.
Thank you, and thank you too for your seven rules of great B2B marketing. What struck me actually about those were how much you focused on the content of marketing. And I wondered whether there should also be maybe a few supplementary rules that you gave us for distribution.
Well, you know what, I don't want to over-egg the whole content thing. What I wanted to do is tune into the fact that what we want to create is distinctive brand assets that are recognizable regardless of the content as yours. And I'm going to use a really cheesy but useful example, okay? When I walk into the shops in my local retail outlet, in fact, whether I'm in Timbuktu or Tahiti, okay, I will see a red can of cola. And I don't have to think, I just know it's Coca-Cola. And if there's a blue can, I know it's Pepsi. And I know if there's a green one, I know it's 7-Up. Okay, that's the level of stuff. That's the nirvana of distinctive brand assets that we're aiming for. So when I say content, I'm referring to is say, oh, if it's Openjaw, and they're the guys who do the purple and blue stuff, which we do, and orange, and all their material, all their content, regardless of the channel I see it, is all really of a high quality. Okay, and a subset of that actually is, I'm sure that the other folks in this call do it as well, is I have this notion called creating incredible value. So in other words, the material you read from Openjaw is as good as you'll get by paying the shops in a book or whatever. We don't do any sales pitches in any of our content that we're out there when we're trying to develop top of funnel stuff. It's all it's documents, data, stuff that people can really learn a lot from.
That's brilliant. Thank you, Colin. I'm glad you managed to get a bit of a plug in for Openjaw before the end there. I'm very impressed.
Well, I just have Bitcoin came into my account, so I actually did the plug. Thanks, Dave. Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks to you, Colin, and thanks to our other brilliant speakers, Richard Robinson, Perrin Falk, and Robert Norham. Thanks to our brilliant backroom team of Louise Neal, Claire Sheriff, Elise Bailey Probert, Alex Horn, and Jay Neal. And thanks to you for participating. You can listen again to this webinar from tomorrow. Next week's show and tell webinar looks at how change affects business marketing with Omma Bonos, Fran Brosen, Virtual Stocks, Tim Ferguson, Panasonic Business Solutions, Rachel Hind-Harris, and Grape's Daria Partus. Available to download now is our weekly podcast. This week, it's all about branding. And if you sign up to be a member of the Business Marketing Club, you can get access to all of our events and webinars, to our mentoring service for business marketers, to our white papers and blogs free of charge. Details of all of that at businessmarketingclub.org.uk. You can contact me if you want at davestevensnow@gmail.com. But that's it. So on behalf of everyone here, thanks so much for taking part today. Have a great evening. Bye for now.